Good morning and welcome to a new episode of the Equidemia podcast. I'm your host. My name is Selina Skogan, and today we'll take a step back in time and a leap forward in understanding, because my guest today is Stefania Vermold from Equine Studies, and we are going to talk about where horses come from, what shaped them, and what does that mean for how we train, keep and understand them today. We'll explore domestication, the shifting purpose of horses through history, the ethics of modern breeding, and of course, primary traits, and that they still shape the behavior and the needs of the horse. So let's get into it. Hello, Stefania. Nice to have you here.
Yeah, nice to be here.
Before I'm getting into the topic, maybe you would like to give us a little bit of background about yourself, because already about your own history, how you got interested in primary traits and all of that, that would be worth an own episode. So I don't want to keep all of that from our listeners.
What you said, I'm Stefania Vermeulen from Equine Studies, and a little bit of my history. I think I love horses all my life. When I was a very young child, I watched horses, and since then I have horses. I was a horse trainer, I was a body worker, and during the body work training, my partner said, Stefania, I think we have to introduce a special teacher who can share with us her anatomy and biomechanics during the dissections. And that's when in 2013, I met Sharon May Davis, and she's my teacher. She introduced me to the topic I teach, preach nowadays about the primitive traits, because she did research in a particular area of the horse, the deepest layer of the neck. And and she had a lot of requests. And I thought, okay, if I can cooperate with her, that I can give her what she needs, she can teach me how to dissect horses and be an anatomist. And yeah, she gets answer to her questions. And that's actually how our journey began. Because I asked her, I introduced her in an excursion to the Koninck horses in Holland. They are semi-wild. And at that point, she said, during the excursion, she said, Stefania, I never ever have seen such a symmetric horse. Look, the biomechanics is almost normal. And and that was actually the beginning of that sentence, that I thought, okay, I have to study the Dutch Koninck horses to know what my biomechanics are. And also, the keeper of the herd, she was very interested in sharing her research, and she offered us some of her horses, so we can start our research about wild horses. And when we had the two Dutch Koninck horses on the dissection table, Sharon had an answer on her question about the deepest layer of the neck, but we got so much more of that Koninck horse. It was amazing. And back then I didn't realize how important this particular dissection was for the rest of my life. And my company is giving the knowledge about anatomy and the biomechanics, and all of
yes.
That.
So today, 15 years later, you are a full-time anatomist. You're dissecting for a living, basically. But not only that, you are also teaching people like me and other trainers who are interested, and body workers, of course, and also veterinarians in anatomy. You're teaching what you find, your findings in dissections. And I like your slogans, your slogan very much. And you said somewhere, bones never lie.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. So I'm really impressed by the depth that we can get from your knowledge, and that's what I would like to talk today about, so we can spread the world a little bit more, and we can bring a little bit more physiology out there into the world. So let's start at the root, and that is domestication. And this word is used so often in conversations around horses, but what does it actually mean from a scientific standpoint?
Yeah, actually, from a scientific standpoint, I don't know, but what it actually mean is that when we took the horses under our care, that means domestication. So they are not living in their own their natural habitat, and not by their own care. So when we took the horses to our place for our needs, that's actually domestication.
And that's already the moment where we are starting to select, right? Because we decide which horses are we breeding on, and so on.
Yeah, so what the story tells is that and I that's a little bit shortcut
Of course, yeah, in
in
the
my
podcast, of course.
yeah. In my lectures, but I said when we meet the horses in the first place, we met the horses for our food. So we did run after them, and there was one smart, I think it was a guy, maybe it was a talk between campfire between the man and his wife. But at one point, we decided, okay, if we can ride them, we don't have to run.
We
So,
don't have to run after them anymore
So if we can ride them,
now.
we are just that fast. And I think at one point, when we sat on the back, there were more possibilities for us in the future. So that's where it all began. And also the story tells us if we couldn't ride them, we ate them. So there are proofs around campfires about that. So I didn't see the proof, but that's what history
Oh, what history
tells us.
says. And I think there's a quite big study about the Botai culture that was recently released some years ago. It was very interesting. And of course, just reading a book about it, and the book's title is actually about the opposite, that somewhere now in the last century, horses and humans, the path of horses and humans has split. While for many thousands of years, the paths of humans and horses were so close, yeah, woven into each other. And that's a little bit, of course, also the story about domestication, because what traits are we selecting for, and what are we eating? So what do we want to keep? And what do we want to eat? Oh God, that even rhymes.
Yes.
And there you said, of course, we are then selecting on horses that are easy to handle, that we can easily use,
Yep.
and that we can easily ride.
Yes. Yeah, and that was actually the beginning of a future. So it's almost hard to think about that was the beginning of our lives, our mobile phones, our microwave in the kitchen.
We would definitely not be where we are today without the horse.
No, but I think when we started to selecting horses, also History said it was a 5 until 6,000 year ago. So yeah, and that's when we started to select the horses. We started to breed horses. We create horses, small, big, elegant, less elegant.
Elegant, less elegant. Yeah, whatever we liked, right? And also depending on the use case, of course, because if we are using a horse for transporting goods, it needs to be have a different type of robustness than a horse that we use for riding, where we are maybe more selecting on trainability or soft gaits or something.
Yeah, it
So
is
of
actually amazing if you dive a little bit into this topic. When I was in the UK for a dissection, of course, and they were offered us a Dartmoor horse, so we went into the Dartmoor area and we visit their little museum. And what we saw was actually a horse was it was too little for mine working, so they bred it with Arabs. It was a little bit taller, and then it was very fitted for mining. So it is actually amazing when you dive into history, what we create actually, and what we mix breed with all kind of
With
breeds.
each other, with the, yes, it was different types, and because also in nature, the horse is of course adapting to the environment it's living in. So therefore, the Arab just looks different than the Dartmoor pony or the Norwegian cold blood trotter. The lynx has here. Do you know the lynx has? No,
No.
it looks a little bit like a small Icelandic horse. Really funny. They re look really funny and a little bit primary still. But they look, of course, very, very different from a German warm blood and everything else. And a part of that is our influence. So, if we look at the horses in our stables today, how much of that original wild horse is still in there? It's a question we need to ask, right?
And in all honestly, I can say because I don't know. Sometimes when I dissect a warm blood, we find atavism, and atavism means that it is added that some pieces of a horse. It's not a good expression, but goes throw us back to many eras ago. And you don't know. You can ultrasound horses, but why should you? So the last dissection we had, it was a week ago, and we found a muscle, very tiny, very thin, throw over the fetlock area, a little bit above the fetlock. We never saw it before. We never saw it. So it was paper wrap thin with a linen tendon sheet. And so I asked Sharon, did you see this before? And she said it is very rare. And we discussed, and I asked her, do you think it is a primitive trait? And she said, no, it is atavism.
What
So
is
we have
atavism?
atavism is that it appears now and then.
Okay, as a
And
genetic variation, basically.
yeah,
Just
and it
sometimes.
yeah, you can breed it. So it is not something what you can bred. It's still also now and then. We have horses with remnants of multiple toes. It's
Yes.
also atavism.
Ah, yeah, I see.
So it was actually it was we were so surprised because it's very rare. And sometimes you see also muscle fibers in for example a ligament. For example, the flexors, the deep flexors. So yeah, that's also atavism. For example, the I forgot the name. In Dutch, it is tussenpees. But the old word is interosseous muscle.
Okay.
So it already has the muscle name in it.
Interesting.
Yeah. And nowadays in warm bloods, we found there's some muscle fibers in it. Yeah, can happen.
So that's interesting. And the concept of primary traits in horses, what can you explain that a little deeper? What is it and why do they matter? So what are primary traits?
Yeah, we call it primitive traits,
Oh,
but
I'm sorry.
yeah, no worries. I also like the primary because for me it's yeah, it's very important. What we see in primitive horses, actually, what primitive means is traits in horses. What is yeah, ages ago. And so, for example, the very, very old latest horse breed, the Tarpan in our area, had traits. What makes them very stable, but also very flexible, and it is because of adaptation, environment adaptation. They need it to keep the body strong, to walk over the hardest ground.
Surface, yeah.
Yep. And yeah, and they survive there. So when we and I come back to the list of primitive traits. So the environment was harsh for us, in our opinion, harsh. For them, it's totally
Totally
normal,
fine, yeah.
totally fine. But they could, yeah, run over it. They ate from variable heights, from trees, from bushes, from the ground, and yeah, that keeps them very strong and healthy. When we took the horses under our care, most of the time it is practically the same as we do nowadays. So they don't walk that much anymore. So if we can't walk over that surface, we make it more flat. So that's for us also very very good to walk about, but also the nutrition we gave them, it's different when what they ate in the wild. So of course, when the horses were kept in our under our care in our environment, yeah, it became very poorly actually. So if you change the environment, you lose some quality because you don't need it anymore.
Okay, that we have to take slowly because I think that is super important. So what you're saying on the one hand, if I get that correctly, is that we have been creating softies. Simply,
Stop this. Yeah.
yeah, because we took away the hardship of life. We got a little comfortable and then we can't talk exactly about couch potatoes when we are talking about horses, but that's basically what it is. We have been creating couch potatoes, and we see, or let me phrase it differently, if we would put our modern warm blood back into the wild, they would have problems surviving.
Yeah, and you see it also nowadays. We discussed it the last time. Now you in Holland, but I see it all over the world. What we want is create a little bit more what we took away from them. So the preaches that we want a horse get out of the stables more that they have that they can choose. At a Paddock Paradise, browsing paddock, rich environment, that's very popular. And what we see nowadays is that a lot of horses, they can't make it.
They aren't fit
So
for survival there.
yes, yeah. So that's actually, yeah, the proof of, yeah,
Of the theory.
the couch potatoes.
The couch
No, that,
potatoes.
yeah, that's actually proof what we did to our horses. So they are not as strong as, yeah, the horses in the wild. So we have to select, the horses better that we can give them back what we took from them.
Yeah, because we are seeing this movement, as you said, that we are getting more and more sensitive also to the mental state of the horse, and we are starting to acknowledge it's a herd animal. It should have movement. It should walk at least a certain amount of kilometers. Usually, people are talking in between 12 to 14 kilometers a day, and so on and so on. And I
Yeah,
still
that's
see,
absolutely true.
yeah,
Absolutely.
absolutely
Yes.
true. But still, we see that if we are putting our horses, the modern horses there, especially I think in the last generation. So a lot of the horses that I'm seeing now that are under 10 are simply not fit for survival in as soon as we are loading them, and if it is just loading with a pet of paradise. And that's of course very interesting, and I would like to dive with you into that a little deeper. But let's first stay with the primitive traits a little bit more. Because I would like to hear a few more of examples of that traits. And I remember that you and Tirza, you also did a comparative dissection in between zebra and horse.
Yes.
And you have done a lot of dissections of conic horses. So you have seen a lot of really primitive ho horses. Am I allowed to call them horses or equines, maybe?
Yeah, equidae. So yeah,
Yeah,
equine species.
it's not exactly the same species anymore. And there I would like to pick your brain and hear what were the biggest takeaways there. You have already been talking about the concept of stability and flexibility, so yeah.
Yeah, so in the first place, what Sharon and I dissected and did research on was the Dutch conic horses in Holland, the Przewalskis in Hungary, the Bosnian mountain horses in Slovenia, the zoo in Holland, they offered us a grand zebra. And they were all offered us with problems. So it is not a healthy horse. So that's one of the things I have to mention. I will not go deeper into what they had, but so that was actually our research. And what they all shared was because there are also differences in between those horses. So what they all had was a full nuchal ligament lamella, and that's actually an anatomy an anatomic word. So the deepest layer of the neck has a funicular cord from the back of the head until the withers, and in between the neck vertebrae and the funicular cord there is nuchal ligament lamella. And that is a ligament what is very strong but also very supple. And the purpose of that nuchal ligament lamella is that the horse can go, of course the horse can go down with the neck, but also can go up because the head is very heavy, and the ligament of the nuchal ligament lamella, it makes the neck is very supple and very strong. So they can telescope, they can go down, they can go up. Nowadays, and that was the question of Sharon and her research and also her PhD, that in the study books from or the textbooks from the history, It was drawn in from the second cervical vertebrae until the seventh. And that was not what she found or we found all over the world. And she, her question was, did we lose it over time or was it drawn in? And actually, that's the start of her request. And we found it in the Dutch Coney Course, in the Grand Zebra, in the Przewalski, and in the Bosnian Mountain Horse, but not that strong in every horse. So there were some differences. She also found it in a Faroe donkey. So her answer was, okay, I think during over time, during breeding, during selection, we lost it. So that's about the nucleligament lamella. What we also found were muscle development that was much more and much stronger and in function. And for example, in the head, the chewing muscle, the muscle nostrils, actually for eating, the purpose for eating, that was much more and much stronger. And what we noticed is also the environment where those equidae lived. So, for example, the Przewalski, they lived in a very big field, acres and acres and acres. And in the summertime, the grass was until their withers. So they ate from the ground, but also for higher precision. And they can pick and choose whatever they want. And also what we saw at the Dutch Coney horses, but also at the Bosnian Mountain horses. So they live more in forest areas where they have woods and harsh terrain. What we found out is that they also ate from variable feeding positions. So they have to pick precisely their food. And because of to pick the precisely the food, the muscles were more developed and more present in those horses. But there was much more in muscle. So also what we saw in those horses is actually very comparative. So they had to walk over harsh terrain. And also the zebra in presence, not our zebra in the zoo, but the zebra in presence, they don't walk over a golf terrain. No, it is very harsh. It's very uneven. And what we saw is so much more developed psoas, a much more, and in function, quadratus lumborum, what lays down underneath the psoas to the lumbar withers. And it's, of course, it was so logic that they can move in harsh terrain up and down over rocks. And then you realize what we took away from our domestic horses. So we want it in training, but if you can't offer them from birth, how would you develop it by training? With 1 hour
With
training
1 hour of
a
movement a day, that is difficult.
day.
I have a question there for you because if I'm understanding you correctly, it's not only the development of the muscle that is different in between domesticated horses and more primitive horses, but also the muscle tissue itself is more, it's simply more bigger.
Yes.
So I know that from rehabilitation cases there we are always talking about these 36 hours where, we get this muscle degeneration if it isn't moved due to injury or due to whatever. But if I'm understanding that correctly, that also means that basically our housing and the domestication process itself took away muscle tissue.
Yes.
Wow. Let that sink in. I mean, that's a big one. Yeah. Interesting. That is really interesting. And that is also interesting when we are looking, for example, at Icelandic horses that are taken out of their natural environment and then moved into a German or a Dutch stable. And now the other way around, when I'm trying to put my horses back into a more, natural or wild environment, that it's maybe not so easy for them to cope in both directions.
No, and I think when we start to breed with those horses, maybe not the next generation, but some generations after them, they can cope. I believe in that. Yes.
But that also means that because my next question here on the list was, how does training influence these traits?
I think
But
I
that's
already
really
asked it
yeah,
a few
exactly,
times.
because that is basically irrelevant. We can't influence these traits. They are there or they aren't.
Yes. Yeah, and the biggest trait what impressed me the most is actually the extra ligament at the splint bone, at the nodule of the splint bone. And they blend in the suspensory ligament. That was the name, suspensory ligament, what was used called interosseous muscle. And actually, that is what makes the recoil system so much stronger.
Stable, yeah.
Absolutely, that we filmed the range of motion of the hoof joint. An hoof capsule of the zebra, and what we
Yeah.
saw was that there was so much range of motion, and that makes that the horse is so much stable in their body. And yeah, for us, if I look at a lot of domestic horses, they lost their recoil system. They lost the strength of recoil system. So yeah, what we did found is not only primitive with primitive traits, but also more domestic horses with primitive traits.
I have to sort that a little bit in my head, because if we are talking about this extra ligament that is lost more or less in many horses, and if we are talking then also about the alteration in the knuckle ligament, that is a huge damage to the recoil system and also to the energy saving system of the horse,
Yes.
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's explaining a lot of the things that I'm seeing in day-to-day life when we are talking about trainability and where we have the borders of trainability also.
Yeah, if we think about that is the systems, the sacropelvic sling system, the back, the thoracic sling system, the neck, and the recoil system. What I saw in a museum in Leiden in Holland, I saw a tarpon, and he a skeleton of a tarpon. I not saw a tarpon, the skeleton of a tarpon. And what I saw was the sacropelvic ligaments between the sacrum and the pelvis. It was so much stronger qua ligament. And I thought, gee, we lost also a lot of structures of that connection too. And that for me, it realized that it is 10 to 12 in our domestic horses. We have to take more care of their system. We have to rethink what we are doing actually, basically.
Are we talking about rethinking training or rethinking breeding or rethinking housing?
I think rethinking everything. It's also a beautiful process. If you imply that knowledge, and if you think about it, you can we always can do better. But
Yeah, of
then
course.
we have a choice, what is in our capability to do better. And sometimes for me, I'm a small breeder of Bosnian mountain horses, so I can do better in select in breeding, if you love to do management, you can think and do better in your management and environment. If you are a horse trainer, you can change the way of training. I believe that we can do a little bit of everything. We can't change what we can't. And we have to
No.
accept that.
Yes. But some things we can make a choice every day to do a little better. At least, so we try. And at least for me, it's true that the more I'm understanding about physiology, the more logical training becomes.
Yes.
That's very, very simple, and we don't need to think about any more of what shape do we want and what technique do we need, but more about what can the horse give us. Also, that's really, really interesting. And now I've lost completely my red thread here.
Yeah, that's actually a little bit what I do. A lot of people
Losing
complain about
the
that. Yeah, that effect
red
does I have on people, yeah.
thread. It's also so interesting that you can dive here a little bit deeper and there a little bit deeper, and chuck,
So
the red thread
yeah,
is gone.
that's absolutely the truth, because the topic is so big
Yes.
that yeah, you can go lost.
You can go wild a bit there.
Yeah. Literally.
Because I wanted to dive a bit into breeding now with you, that was my plan, and that the role of the horse from war to agriculture to modern sport has of course also shaped what we have selected for in breeding.
Yeah. We create what we want, right?
And what is it that we wanted?
Yeah, but if I look at more from a sport perspective, because I think that was what we no, it's not a good sentence. Wait, I think the sport created a lot of sport horses, and that's what we thought we wanted. So what we figured out, for example, in racehorses, how to create horses what go faster. So you have to look into long legs, more range of motion of the legs that create faster horses. And that's where we as a human are good in it. If we want to more elegance, for example, for in dressage, we have to create a little bit long legs with high for example knee accent. So we created that. For jumping, for example, we created also that the horse can jump higher and go a little bit faster. So also in Icelandic horses, the popularity is that they can run faster and can go lift the legs a little bit higher. So if you have to have more range of motion in legs, you have to select on longer bones. So longer bones means less stability in the horse. So if you have a table or a chair, for example, with long legs, it's not so stable.
I guess all of us have been enjoying a bar table outside, now in the nice, beautiful weather, and we know how easy it is to tip over. And then we compare it to our kitchen table, and that's a completely different thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you think a little bit like architect
Architecture.
wise, yeah, then everything is more simple. So what we create nowadays, it costs.
It costs us
Everything
something.
costs. Yes,
Yeah.
yeah.
And I hear a lot of people complaining about that we are creating, or that in sport especially, there's horses created that can only be ridden from high performance riders. But I would, especially when I'm talking to you now here, say we are creating horses that are not fit for riding at all. And I'm seeing in the warm blood that we just within the last 50, 70 years, we have been kind of compressing the horse from rectangular to more like a
Yeah, square.
square. Thank you. That was the word I was missing. More like a square. And that is doing something also to the positioning of the bones and of the function. That's something that I'm seeing very often. The function of the fetlock is compromised.
Yeah, the whole suspension of the horse is compromised. So the people can't hear that you almost choke, right?
No. I just took off. I took off the microphone for the choking moment.
Honestly, yeah, the choke came on the right moment because it is heartbreaking if we look at the conformation of horses nowadays and how they easily break down in early stage.
How could we come there?
I think it's both. It's at several ways. If I look at selecting and breeding, but also raising young foals nowadays. We raise and select, and I don't make myself very popular if I say this, but more or like horses who are giving their lives to us for our needs. And that doesn't mean that they don't have a voice anymore, but we kill it almost from the first few months when the horse is born, and we raise and train him in very early stage, that they can do what we want with them.
Oh, you're in the right podcast. I'm often not very popular with what I'm saying. It's part of the truth. And we are also, on the other hand, we are seeing, I think we are at an important crossroad in our time and age now.
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Because when I'm discussing with Frauke, who's reading our biopsychology lectures, she's always saying that when she did her PhD thesis, she had to fight for the point that animals are having emotions. And nobody is discussing that today anymore, because this is just, of course, animals are having emotions. And if we're accepting that, then we can also look further, and then we can see how is training, keeping everything around it, influencing this emotions, influencing this behavior, and then we are on a point where we can raise a lot of ethical questions
Yes.
into different directions. And then we are, so this is the one crossroad that is that one part of the crossroad. The other crossroad that is coming is that we're acknowledging emotions, we are acknowledging pain. And if we can see pain behavior, and these two are crossing, that is, and this is what I feel where we are at this crossing, and where we need to think about, okay, if these two lines are crossing, where would we like to continue from here on? So how is that influencing, if we can acknowledge all that, and then we are coming into your area of expertise, physiology. Where do we have to look at physiology? What are the factors that we have to acknowledge there? What can we do with just good decisions? How am I having my horse? How am I feeding my horse? Do I want to take a foal away with 6 months from its mother, or is it maybe 2 years later also fine? And so on. So I think it's also, like you said, I'm not giving up hope. I think there's a beautiful space in front of us, ahead of us, where we can take sensible decisions for shaping a better future.
Yeah, I agree on that. And it start always, where do you or what you want to change for the future? So yesterday I was at a client's place for an assessment, and he had three Spanish horses, two geldings, one mare with a foal. And they live separately in the paddock. And I saw the foal with the mom, And the fool was expressing himself very, he was 3 months old, very expressive. And I thought, okay, there is no one who can regulate the fool. No one. Because the mom was not fit. So there was also a request for assess the mom. And I said to them, if I look at her body, she almost break. She
Ah, that's
isn't,
sad.
yeah, she's not fit to ride her anymore. She cannot break. She break with her forehand, and she's compensate on that. So she can't regulate her boy. So he will become a very yeah, a boy with no boundaries. So I asked them, can you, hey, how are the geldings? And she said, both of the geldings, they can be suited to as a companion for the mare. So I said, you have to think about that, because otherwise your boy will be hard to handle. So yeah, that's also a consideration. If you can't ride your mare, often we say, okay, we put a foal in it, but that's not the case. Your mare has to be fit to raise the kid properly. And if your mare is not fit, she can raise him. Yeah, he will be
He will be born, but
absolutely, and he will be raised, and he will be eat and walk, whatever, but the self-regulated system, it is not good. It is not developed very good. So he will be oversensitive. He will be yeah, that he will be over his boundaries, but also over boundaries of others. So if I look at my own small breeding, for me, that's the start. How do I see that my mares or my stallion are able to give the offspring that what they need? Is exactly with children. So yeah, so that's yeah where it all starts, to raise mentally and physically health young baby. Because I believe that that goes hand in hand.
I would agree with you completely, and I see the difference in when horses are arriving at our place, you can immediately say how have they been raised, because it's a huge difference in how they are coping in the flock then. Yeah, and we have discussed that before, that when Rachel was here, she said that the horses are not behaving normal, that they are behaving more like primitive or like wild horses than like domesticated horses. I take that as a compliment for low pressure
Absolutely.
and low stress levels. But on the other hand, that means that if there's a bully coming in, they don't want to be engaged with him. They put him on the side, and usually the leader of the flock is taking care of him for a period of time. And when he's starting to relax, when he can start to regulate and everything, then he's allowed to enter the flock step by step. So you can see very early on, from the first day onwards, kind of how was the horse bred, how full is the worry cup, how is he able to cope with social structures. But that's just one part of the story, and I would just go into your brain there a little bit more, because we are not only talking about stress, self-regulation, nervous system, of course, but also when we are taking sensible decisions for the future, we need to talk about physiology. And then the question is, because I see this trend, maybe only in Germany, but I see, and in Norway too, but I see this trend that if a mare is not fit for riding, if a stallion is not fit for riding, we take it for breeding. Is that a good gene pool for the future?
Yeah, for me, no. Because I think I see it in my own stallion. He is almost 19 years old now. He was for a long time period of time. He has some injuries, some bad injuries. Also, he has an airway problem. I solved the airway problem chronically. But what I see is because of his history, where he came from, he's not able to do certain jobs. For example, send the babies away to the moms. He does not do that, but also he's not able to at certain age, okay, I want to that you get out of the herd. So he doesn't take that for his job. So he is not fit for that job, and that means that my offspring cannot self-regulate as properly as I would be. So also my mares, I have one mare and she has a very rare bloodline. She is also she has some traumas in her body. And what I see is that she accepts so much more from her foal than my both other mares who are very very fit. So yeah, breeding isn't about oh we not suited for sport and we breed. No, breeding is top sport. You have to be fit mentally, because if you're tired or actually mentally full, it's way harder to guide your child when you're
Oh
fit.
yes, as the mother of a young child, I can tell you that is so true.
Yeah. So, and that's exactly the same with our horses, exactly the same. And we are producing horses. We are not able to look at a healthy breeding program, sorry.
Yeah, and also from an orthopedic perspective, we know that horses who are prone to issue or where the parents already had issues in their body, have a higher chance later on in the offspring to see the same problems.
Yes.
So I'm always saying that, of course, we can do a lot with training and housing and stuff, but longevity is not only if your training was good, is not showing off in 30 years. It's if the breeding was good, that simply has the highest impact on how old does my pony get, how sturdy. I have a 28-year-old in my training program, and he's old. Of course, he's old, and he's showing the traits that an old horse is showing. So a little bit of tritis here and there, but he is one of the horses with the most normal and healthy movement that we have in the academy.
Yeah, and it's not a guarantee that you have that. It's not always, because life is also
No.
life.
Life is cruel,
Yeah, but yeah, but the quality of life is better if it is long or it is short. The quality of life is way better.
What would you, I'm always asking at the end of our episodes, is if you would have one wish or one quote that you're sending out there to the horse world, what you're wishing for the future, the takeaway, what would it be?
yeah, that's it. I have so many.
Think a little moment about it. It's important.
Yeah, for me, I think it is still consideration. If, yeah, and I think I'm one of so many. If your horse says no, then you have to ask yourself, why? Do I Is my question right? Does he understand my question, or does he say no for for other reasons? So we have to investigate more why. And because I believe that if that's the case, the horse doesn't have to change. We have to change thinking and doing.
Stefania, thank you very much
Yep.
for this so thought-provoking conversation. And I think that for many of us out there, it's clear that we want to do better for our horses. But we also have to understand from where are we coming from, biologically, behaviorally, historically, physiology, all of this, and taking sensible decisions for the future. So I'm very curious what will come next. You are bringing the next online dissection in November, I think.
Yes, yeah.
So we will link in the show notes your web page that people can find you. And I'm always
Great.
recommending everybody that you should take a couple of dissections. I took a few already, and I think I'm learning so much new stuff each time. I have a little bit trouble.
But it's also with us. Every dissection, the horse gives us so much information, and it's not only the damage what he can share with us during his life, but also atavism or Asians things. So it's always nice puzzle.
Yeah, it is. It's so super interesting. And we will, for our members, as usual, also prepare an affiliate link that is coming then in time for the dissection. And again, I can just recommend that it's important that we learn more about physiology and that we are just brushing off one or the other myth from our shoulders that we have been carrying along for too many years, because also we have a tendency to fall back onto the old masters and say, but the old master said or the old masters did. I am pretty sure that none of the horses that we have today would have ever arrived the battlefield. So it's maybe not the old master's fault, but maybe we can just step into the future with open eyes and learn more. So thank you very much for today.
Yeah, very welcome. It was my pleasure.
See you soon.